Welcome to the deep dive. Today we are strapping in for a pretty forensic examination of the official congressional record.
We are. The date is December 18th, 2025.
And this wasn't just, you know, a day of votes. It was really a snapshot of a highly polarized legislative body.
Yeah, grappling with these massive national issues, things like how we build infrastructure, who gets healthcare funding.
And right alongside that, you have these quiet, hyper-local community recognitions that almost always go unnoticed.
That's right. And our mission here is to synthesize all of that for you. We're comparing the sharp public rhetoric from the floor debates against the quieter, but just as important insights that are kind of buried in the technical bill language and crucially in the extensions of remarks.
The EORs. Yeah.
You might think Congress only fights, but this record shows them working on, well, everything. Environmental reform, intense healthcare policy, even celebrating high school football champions.
It's the whole spectrum of government in one day.
It really is.
Okay, let's unpack this and jump straight into the action. We're focusing on three major legislative items that were debated and passed in the House that day.
And they really paint a picture of these competing priorities, you know, deregulation versus protection.
So can you give us the quick legislative docket?
Absolutely. All three were hotly contested. They all passed by pretty narrow margins.
I bet.
First up, we had H.R. 4776. That's the Standardizing, Permitting, and Expediting Economic Development Act, or the SPEED Act.
The SPEED Act. Okay.
It's all about overhauling how major projects get approved. It passed by a yay and nay vote, roll number 356. The final tally was 221 ayes, 296 nays.
Wow, yeah, a clear partisan divide right there. The numbers don't lie.
They don't. The second item was H.R. 1366, the Mining Regulatory Clarity Act. That also passed the House. It's about establishing, well, firm legal ground for resource extraction.
Okay.
And then finally, the third big one, and this one generated a lot of heat, was H.R. 498, the Do No Harm in Medicaid Act.
That was sponsored by Mr. Crenshaw of Texas, right?
That's the one. And it passed even closer. Roll number 362. 215 ayes to 201 nays.
So let's start at that first one, the largest regulatory battle of the day, the SPEED Act, H.R. 4776. This bill is, I mean, it's essentially a direct challenge to the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA.
It is. NEPA is the bedrock of environmental reviews in this country.
So what did the proponents of this reform say was so broken?
The main argument from proponents was that the process has become a regulatory leviathan. That was the word used by Representative Hageman of Wyoming.
A leviathan.
Yeah. Her core contention was that the permitting process has been, quote, corrupted, that it's turned a procedural law into a weapon for activists to block innovation and development.
Crippling American industries is the argument.
That's the argument. The whole push was to impose these hard, non-negotiable deadlines on federal agencies for finishing their environmental reviews.
The idea being that these reviews currently take years, right? Turning a two-year construction project
into a 10-year regulatory slog. Exactly. Representative Carter of Georgia really hammered this point home. He argued that these endless regulations are, quote, crushing us.
And that they're a direct factor in the high cost of living.
A direct quantifiable factor. They see it as an economic bottleneck that's contributing to inflation and slow growth. The bill aimed to restore NEPA to what they say was its original purpose.
Which was?
Just a disclosure document. Not this massive veto power it's become.
But, I mean, if you're cutting those timelines so drastically, the opposition must be arguing you're just forcing agencies to cut corners.
And that's exactly where the counterargument came in. It was led very strongly by Representative Huffman of California.
What did he say?
He argued the SPEED Act takes a sledgehammer to one of our foundational environmental laws. That it forces agencies to just disregard long-term consequences, shut out community input, all to meet some artificial political deadline.
So the environmental effects just get ignored in favor of speed.
That's the fear. And this is where the record gets so powerful, because it connects this high-level DC policy debate to a real-world localized problem.
Yeah, there was a specific example cited during the floor debate, right, about Nevada.
There was. The record highlighted that despite all these efforts to streamline clean energy projects, right now there are 33 gigawatts of solar and storage projects in Nevada that are effectively in limbo.
33 gigawatts.
33. That's a massive amount of power generation capacity just stuck waiting on paperwork. It's a staggering example of the energy sector's struggle that the Speed Act is trying to fix.
It's hard to argue the current system is efficient when you hear a number like that.
It really is.
Okay, switching gears slightly, but staying in that same regulatory realm, the House also passed H.R. 1366, the Mining Regulatory Clarity Act. This one didn't get as much rhetorical airtime, but it's huge for Western starts.
It is. And the central issue is, well, clarity. Over the decades, there's been intense conflict over claims staked under the 1872 mining law.
The fight is over whether land used for non-mining activities, like waste storage or processing, maintains its regulatory status.
Exactly. This bill seeks to solidify the land rights for miners. It makes sure that all the related facilities you need for a mining operation, like water treatment plants or tailings facilities, are definitively covered under that original claim.
So it's about reducing uncertainty, which industry always loves. But it sounds like environmental groups would see that as a green light to just expand operations without any new assessment.
Precisely. For proponents, the goal is to unlock domestic mineral production, make it easier to get crucial elements for batteries and tech without facing endless lawsuits over land use.
And opponents.
Opponents see it as an encroachment on public lands and a reduction of federal oversight. Mm-hmm. They argue that if you want to use that land for a new purpose, a new environmental review should apply. You shouldn't get a blanket clearance based on a law that's 150 years old.
Another classic DC battle. Economic development versus a precautionary regulatory approach.
It's a tale as old as time.
It really is. Now, shifting to the mechanics of Congress, because this is fascinating. All three of these big bills faced a motion to recommit, or an MTR.
Mm-hmm.
For you, the learner who might be following these votes, understanding the MTR is so critical to seeing how strategy is actually deployed on the floor.
It's arguably the most powerful tool the minority party has left at the end of a House debate. It's their final procedural move before the bill gets officially engrossed and sent over to the Senate.
And in theory, it sends the bill back to committee for revision.
In theory.
But in practice, what does it really do?
In practice, it's a political weapon.
Mm.
It's almost always used to force a final, very visible roll call vote on a specific amendment.
Often one that's designed to be a politically difficult choice for the majority party.
Exactly. The minority knows their MPR is probably going to fail,
yeah.
But they use it to force every single member to publicly take a position on a policy that is really difficult to vote against back in their home district.
Which perfectly describes the case study we saw with H.R. 498, the Do No Harm in Medicaid Act.
It does. Just before the vote on that bill, which was already so contentious, Mr. Soto of Florida submitted a motion to recommit.
And his motion included an amendment to do what?
To extend enhanced ACA premium tax credits, that's Section 36B, it would extend them until 2029.
So a massive, very popular healthcare subsidy under the Affordable Care Act.
A huge one. So strategically, the minority party forced the majority into a choice.
Vote against extending popular health insurance subsidies or vote against your own leadership by supporting the MTR.
It's a direct challenge. It puts their entire healthcare platform on blast right before they vote on the gender transition funding bill.
And even though the MTR failed and the main bill passed,
it succeeded in forcing that recorded public vote.
Yeah.
That roll call is now part of the permanent record. You can be sure it'll be used in campaign ads for years to come.
It's a powerful lesson in how these battles are fought with parliamentary rules, not just rhetoric. Now, let's pivot sharply away from the heat of the floor debate and the procedural wars to the quieter moments that get recorded in the extensions of remarks, the EORs.
This is where members can submit statements that were not spoken on the floor, but they are officially entered into the record.
And it really gives you a window into the nonpartisan, hyperlocal side of Congress.
It really shows the full scope of a representative's duties. It's often about constituent service and local recognition.
Like what? What did we see?
Well, for example, Representative Vicente Gonzalez of Texas used an EOR to honor a man named Danny Cortez for 40 years of service.
40 years?
40 years promoting reliable electric service in South Texas, first with Central Power and Light, and then AEP. It's this quiet but really significant acknowledgement of blue-collar longevity in a critical industry.
And we saw a similar focus on labor up in Illinois.
We did. Representative Garcia of Illinois honored Carl Rosen. He called him an architect of working class power in Chicago and a master tactician and negotiator for the United Electrical Workers.
These are powerful, specific accolades for local leaders who would never, ever make national news.
Never. And then there's the unity. Representative Nathaniel Moran of Texas honor the cities of Texarkana, Texas, and Texarkana, Arkansas.
For their joint designation as a military-friendly community.
A joint designation. Is it just a powerful snapshot of a moment where people in neighboring towns can put politics aside to honor their veterans? You don't see that on cable news.
No, you don't. And it contrasts so starkly with the partisan trench warfare we were just talking about. What really stands out is the difference in how Congress approaches these sensitive social topics in public versus in local recognition.
The contrast is essential. While the floor was consumed by this fierce debate over H.R. 498, Mrs. Baldwin submitted an EOR recognizing TLC Child and Family Services for its high marks and its, quote, inclusive care for LGBTQ plus youth.
So the record holds both things at once. The national political conflict, and the hyper-local recognition of community organizations doing work in that exact same space.
It's all there.
So let's dive back into that contentious H.R. 498 debate, the Do No Harm in Medicaid Act. The rhetoric, as recorded, was incredibly strong, deeply personal.
It was. The bill's sponsor, Mr. Crenshaw of Texas, urged his colleagues to, and I'm quoting here, strip away the language of euphemisms like gender-affirming care.
And to focus on what he called the reality of it.
The alleged reality of, quote, healthy children being placed on drugs that halt normal development, sterilize them, permanently alter their bodies. The focus for proponents was squarely on the irreversibility of these medical interventions on minors.
And the opposition framed this completely differently as a massive governmental overreach into private medical decisions.
Correct. Lawmakers like Mr. Pallone of New Jersey and Ms. Bonamici of Oregon opposed what they call the deceptively titled bill.
Their argument was that this is politicians interfering with personal health care decisions that should be made by families, doctors, and therapists.
Right. And they argued that the most common form of care medication, to simply pause puberty, is critical for mental health and stability while families make these long-term decisions.
This is where we really have to look past the rhetoric and dig into the actual policy language, because the specifics were incredibly detailed. What exactly was H.R. 498 trying to prohibit Medicaid funding for?
The bill text is dense, but it's illuminating. H.R. 498 specifically prohibited Medicaid funding for procedures performed for the purpose of intentionally changing the body to no longer correspond to the individual sex.
So it wasn't a broad ban on all treatment. It was targeting very specific interventions.
Very specific. It included puberty blockers, certain hormone analogs, and testosterone or estrogen given at supraphysiologic doses.
Okay, that word supraphysiologic is crucial. Unpack that for us.
It just means doses that are higher than what a healthy person of that age and sex would naturally produce. So this shows the legislation was focused specifically on physical body alteration and developmental suppression.
Not just simple hormone maintenance for an existing condition.
Yeah.
And were there any exceptions written into the policy to make sure that kids with other medical conditions were still covered?
Yes, and that is a critical piece of nuance here. The prohibition did not apply to medically necessary procedures to correct for things like precocious puberty. That's where a child enters puberty way too early.
Okay.
It also included specific, detailed exceptions for genetic disorders of sex development, using clinical terms like 46XX with virilization or 46XY with under-virilization.
So it was very technical. It specifically excluded treatments for complex intersex medical conditions.
It did. But it also explicitly included a clause saying the prohibition would not be lifted just to address mental distress.
Yeah.
It shows that Congress was debating clinical policy in minute technical detail.
Absolutely. The legislation was highly specific to the purpose and type of procedure.
Right. Carving out exceptions for physical illnesses while focusing on procedures performed solely for the purpose of gender transition in minors.
So let's step back and synthesize everything we've extracted from the congressional record of December 18th, 2025. In a single day, Congress was navigating these tectonic shifts in environmental law, intensely personal health care battles, all while managing essential but sometimes forgotten bureaucratic tasks.
We saw the high heat of partisan conflict over the Speed Act and H.R. 498. We also saw members dedicating time to local labor heroes and military families. And then there's the material that passed quietly far away from the cameras.
Exactly. Let's return to that massive, high-level national security logistics item that was just submitted into the record, the GSA prospectus.
Right. That prospectus, filed by the General Services Administration, revealed the plans for the renovation of the Ronald Reagan Federal Office Building.
To serve as a consolidated permanent headquarters for the FBI, this is a replacement plan for the old J. Edgar Hoover building.
It is. And the estimated total project cost for this renovation is a massive $844 million.
$844 million. So while America was watching a three-hour debate over Medicaid funding for minors, this nearly billion-dollar construction contract for a major national security agency was just quietly moving through the bureaucratic process.
You have members fighting bitterly over amendments about specific hormone doses.
Right.
But a nearly billion-dollar decision is just entered into the record without extensive debate. It's a potent reminder that the political battles on the floor are highly visible, but the real infrastructure of governance and the allocation of huge funds often happens quietly.
In the dense policy details and these massive documents that are just submitted.
Yep.
So as you, the learner, look at this day in the record, where do you think the real leverage is applied? Is it in the passionate political debate that dictates the narrative, or the quiet authority of the prospectus that dictates the spending?
The record captures all of it. It forces you to look beyond the headlines, to really understand the true complexities of governing.
Powerful stuff. If you want to dive deeper into this contrast, you can look up these specific remarks and the full congressional record for December 18th, 2025 at congress.gov. That's where the facts are.
Until next time.
Dive deep. Stay informed.